The difference between the successful and the unsuccessful is not the absence of obstacles, but the presence of perseverance. When most people meet somebody who they want to be like or achieve the same success as them, they ask the wrong question. I ask the reverse question.
What if the race to being number one is what's holding you back? Working alongside three of the greatest names in the history of leadership development, today's guests learned firsthand that most successful people don't fight their way to the top. Instead, they start by helping others succeed first. As a ghostwriter and collaborator with John Maxwell, Jim Rohn, and Zig Ziglar, today's guest, Chris Weidner, gained unique insights into the minds of these three legendary figures while building his own path to success. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead, because we believe great leaders aren't born or made, they're constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby, two-time best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has upskilled over 2 million people over the past three decades. I'm going to be asking Chris to share his insights on lessons he learned from working side-by-side with legends like John Maxwell, Jim Rohn, and Zig Ziglar, why pushing through challenges leads to breakthrough and lasting impact, how to balance humility and ambition to build a career of influence, and much, much more. You've worked with some of the greatest leaders and minds of our time. What do you believe is the single biggest factor that separates the successful from the unsuccessful?
Well, one of the things that I always say is the difference between the successful and the unsuccessful is not the absence of obstacles, but the presence of perseverance. Because most people, when they hit that obstacle, they quit. Or they might push a little and nothing budges, so they quit. Leaders, people who accomplish things, people who make societal changes, they push and they push and they push because it's not that they don't have an obstacle. It's just that they persevere until they break through the obstacle. So I've always said, really, I mean, and a lot of people don't necessarily talk about this in regard to leadership, but it's perseverance. It's sticking through until the job gets done.
And perseverance is kind of like your life story. So can you give us a little bit of how it has all come to fruition from, you know, growing up to being a pastor to your writing and speaking and how it's all evolved over time?
Yeah. So I was born into a family. I was 9 years younger than my closest sibling. So it was kind of I always joke that my middle name is Whoops. My mom and dad did not have much of a relationship. They were fighting all the time. My dad was in and out of the house and I think I was on a good weekend. I think they were getting along that weekend. And so my mom ended up having me. My dad was the fifth partner at an architecture firm called NBBJ. And I always joke and say he was the first guy to not get a letter. And he was the CFO of NBBJ. And he passed away in 1970. In 1969, as a partner at NBBJ, they had about 150 architects. And he made $90,000 in 1969. That was his income, which is probably about $1 million a year or something like that now. Interestingly enough, here's a fascinating thing. He managed all the money for a 150-person architecture firm with an abacus and a slide rule.
Can you imagine
now,
that?
Now, kids nowadays would be like, what are you talking about? I had to do it all on my watch. I run a $1 billion business on my Apple Watch, you know, or whatever. But my dad in 1970, May 1st, 1970, woke up, had flu-like symptoms. Long story short, November 18th, 1970, he died. We were living in a house, Sandpoint Country Club, overlooking Lake Washington, the Cascade Range, you know, the whole thing, sold for $3.8 million recently. But my dad made one of the biggest mistakes that a lot of people do. He had $30,000 worth of life insurance. That was it. He should have had $1 million, $2 million, whatever he should have had, but he didn't. So he left us in a lurch. And my mom had to sell that house because she couldn't afford $400 a month for the mortgage payment. And so it began a downward spiral. My mother had borderline personality disorder, which made it even harder. And then 28 homes, 11 different schools, shipped off to live with relatives twice, once in the fourth grade, once in the ninth grade, started drugs and alcohol in the sixth grade, smoked opium for the first time in the eighth grade. And I made all my money betting the horses at Long Acres Horse Track, which isn't even there anymore. Now it's Emerald Downs or something.
Love it.
But summer before my senior year, I got invited to go to this little youth group. And here's the way it happened. I spent the night at my biggest pot smoking buddy's house. And Sunday morning, his mother, all 4'11" of her, throws the door open, says, get up, we're going to Sunday school. Now, most people know what Sunday school is. I was raised completely irreligious. I literally did not know what Sunday school was. I'm like, Sunday school? What's Sunday school? And why are we going to school on Sunday? So anyway, long story short, they had this youth minister from Helena, Montana. And he had two things that I needed. First of all, he had size 11 cowboy boots. I needed a big foot up my rump to get me out of, you know, whatever. Second thing was, he said, God has a plan for your life. God has a plan for your life. And I became a Christian. I was being recruited to go to play basketball. I ended up going to this little Bible college that doesn't even exist anymore. I got a degree in biblical studies. And I ended up, my first job was in northern New Jersey in a little town called Mendham. And Mendham is a very affluent, wealthy community, bedroom community in New York. We had bonds traders and, of course, pharmaceutical and oil and, you know, all those kinds of things. And my first business mentor at the time was the senior VP of Mars Candies. And so they're based in McLean, but then they're up in Hackettstown as well. And his kids were in my youth group. And he used to have me out for these events, and I did his daughter's wedding and, you know, all those kinds of things. And he was just, he went from there. He became president of Calcan out in your neck of the woods down in LA, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Mars. And then he got the job, president of Mars, as he told me, the highest job you could get at Mars without your last name being Mars. And so I had so many just great mentors in my life. Left there at the age of 25, and I started a church in Seattle. Starting a church, they call it church planting, right? You go there, and of course, my denomination didn't have any money, so I always tell people they gave me a swat on a fanny and a go get 'em tiger. And when I finally ended up on the board of that denomination and went to my first board meeting, and somebody said, anybody got any questions before we start? And I said, yeah, I got a question. And of course, I'm sitting there with a bunch of 60-year-old men, and I said, I got a question. They said, yeah, sure. What is it? I said, which one of you was the one who made the decision to let me start a church when I was only 25 years old? Because I got a bone to pick with you. But we started two other churches out of that. And then in 2002, I left the full-time pastoral ministry, started writing and speaking full-time. And over the course of 2002 to 2009, I worked with three great, great mentors. One was a guy named John Maxwell. I think John sold 35, 40 million books now. I was a ghostwriter for him. I wrote his nationally syndicated column through the business journals. And then I got a call from a guy named Jim Rohn. And for those of you who don't know who Jim Rohn is, he gave Tony Robbins his first job. And so I spent 7 years working with him, writing with him. I wrote his last book, 12 Pillars, which has sold 1 million copies. It's my only 1 million copy bestseller that I've had. And then I got a call from Zig Ziglar. And he said, would you like to co-host my television show? And I said, gee, sure. And I remember walking into the studio the first time. I'd never met Zig before, but I had built a business where I licensed audio programs from other speakers. We put them into box sets of 14 CDs and one DVD, and we sold them through Costco and Sam's Club. And we were selling 50 to 75,000 boxes a month through Costco and Sam's Club. And our three top titles were Verbal Success, Sales Success, and Leadership Success. So anyway, I was sending Zig big checks already. So he calls me up. I remember the first time I walked into the studio, I tell people I felt like a priest who'd been called to the Vatican to serve communion with the Pope. Like, wow, Zig Ziglar, like he created this industry, really. Him and Norman Vincent Peale and, you know, W. Clement Stone and all those guys. So that's what I've been doing for, you know, a number of years. And then I had written 24 books. I was writing my 25th book. Called The Capitalist. And the books that I write are short. They're 20 to 25,000 words, and they're stories. And usually a mentor and a mentee, The Art of Influence was a book like that. But The Capitalist was the setup to the book. And I'm going to write it, probably my next book. In fact, Maxwell just started a publishing company and wants to publish it. But it's a billionaire tech guy. And the book opens with him taking a phone call from his 96-year-old grandmother, who says, you know, I'm not long for this earth. Would you be willing to host a family reunion this year at your estate in Jackson Hole? And he says, sure. And so he has one sister, and her daughter goes to this screaming liberal Ivy League school majoring in art. And so the whole book is their conversations. And one of the conversations, I'll give you kind of an idea of how my books work and how you teach lessons through this. One of the times like the first night, everybody else has gone to bed. He's working, but he's working in like the living room, and the daughter comes down and she's just got bones to pick the whole way through because she hates capitalism.
Oh yeah.
As many of our college students do. So she starts in on him about how greedy he is and all this. And she points to a piece of art. She says, "How much did that artwork cost you?" And he says, I think I paid $10,000 for it. And she goes, "Do you know what you could do with $10,000 to help people?" And he goes, "Oh man, I know there's lots of things you could do. Like, you know, I know you can build a well in Africa for a village for about $10,000. And the daughter goes, "I have a friend from college who did that last summer. She went and helped build those wells, and that's exactly what they cost. How did you know?" And he said, "I built 1,000 of them last year." And then he says, "And here's the interesting fact. I built those 1,000 wells across 3 countries in Africa. Every one of those countries far richer than I am. They didn't build those wells. A capitalist from America built those wells." And so those are the kinds of lessons. And by the end of the book, I'll give you the, you know, cover your ears if you don't want to know how it ends. She wants to open early on in the book, she sort of reveals that eventually she wants to own an art gallery in New York. So you can imagine who wrote the first check for the art gallery. It was her uncle, because he said, "You know, you're going to need some investors, and those investors are going to want some money back." And, you know, so he kind of brings her around to an appreciation of capitalism through these conversations where she realizes that she hadn't thought it through.
Chris, I got to say that I'm probably going to repeat that story 100 times.
Have at it.
I'm one of those guys that always tells the same story. I love that. I can't wait till that book comes out. Eventually, we're going to get to your current book that you did just come out with. But my question is, I mean, you work with some legends, Zig Ziglar, Jim Rohn, John Maxwell. What was it about you that attracted them to you?
Oh, this is a great lesson. In fact, I'm going to write a book someday called Second Fiddle, or The Power of Second Fiddle. When most people meet somebody who they want to be like or achieve the same success as them, they ask the wrong question. They'll meet somebody, you know, you probably go to investors conferences and things like that, and somebody finally gets to meet their great investor thing, and they go, "Oh, Mr. Jones, I want to be just like you. You know, will you help me?" Well, Mr. Jones doesn't have time to help a guy he just met at a conference. Neither did John Maxwell, Jim Rohn, or Zig Ziglar. I asked the reverse question. I said, "How can I help you?" And John Maxwell said, "I need somebody to write my nationally syndicated column." Jim Rohn said, "I need somebody to write my 1-year personal development program," which we then condensed and turned into 12 Pillars, the book. Zig Ziglar, and I didn't know it at the time, I was a little surprised they invited me to co-host the show with him. I already had a show on the network, and they asked me to co-host. I found out later that he was at the point where he was starting to really struggle with his dementia, and they were afraid he wouldn't remember how to process. By the end of his life, Zig had amazing long-term memory. He could tell you a story that he'd told 1,000 times from when he was 10 years old, but he wouldn't remember that he just told that story, and he would tell it again. So my job was really to be the one who moved us. You know, I always tell people I was like a batting practice pitcher at the home run derby. Everybody knows the guy who's trying to hit home runs. Nobody knows that guy out on the mound just throwing him the pitch right across the plate. So what I realized is everybody else was trying to be first. I realized I got far more power, far more fame, far more money by being number two to 3 of the greatest legends in my industry. People say, "How did you build an amazing career like you did?" And I said, "It's really simple. It's a 3-step process. First, have John Maxwell call you, then have Jim Rohn call you, then have Zig Ziglar call you. Once that happens, it's really just kind of easy from there." So I think the secret and why they chose me was, number one, I had the talent and the giftedness. I was a former pastor turned business speaker. John Maxwell was a former pastor turned business speaker. He knew that I could get his voice and speak his language. And the key was just really willing to not be the guy. And in not being the guy, I became my own guy. And people heard about me who would have never heard about me, or certainly not the speed at which they heard about me.
What I think's great about that is there's nothing wrong with wanting to be the guy. You know, a lot of us are competitive and you want to get there, but while you're not, be humble enough to do exactly what you're saying, because I am sure that this has led to better speaking gigs for you, more exposure, and all this great opportunity, because it sounds like you were able to just put your ego aside and say, "What can I do to serve? What can I do to help?" and look at the tremendous experience it's given you.
Well, think about the tech industry.
Yeah.
Think about all the number two guys.
Mm-hmm.
Ballmer owns a sports team now. Ballmer's worth $40 billion. Wozniak's doing all right for himself, right? You know, you could probably go across all of those industries and you can realize that being number two is not so bad in something that's wildly successful.
You got to write that book because it's so true. And some people don't have the ability to put the ego aside to be able to be okay with being number two or number three or number four. They just think they deserve to maybe play a victim role and get up to be a number one. One story that I don't want to pass over that I thought was awesome that my dad, who also passed away, would have loved is when you ran into John Maxwell and you told him about mortgaging your house.
So I left the pastorate on June 1st or July 1st, can't remember which, 2002. And I thought, I want to get into this business. I'm going to throw a big event. And I knew John already. I had actually taken a biblical studies course, a leadership course from John when he was still a pastor. So I'd known him for a while. He was starting to get pretty big. And so I reached out to him and I, you know, remained in contact somewhat, you know, for years and years. I got invited to this private little meeting with him, I don't know, 2-3 months ago. And we were both happened to be coming out of the bathroom at the same time. He goes, Chris Widener, what are you doing here? So we started talking. And I said, did I ever tell you the story about that event that I did? I still remember it, September 26, 2002. He said, no. And I said, I mortgaged my house to pay your speaker's fee. I took $100,000 out of a $300,000 house, and I wrote you a check for 55 of it. And then I hired the first guy up, first American up Mount Rainier. I've got a big picture of him standing on top of, or not Mount Rainier, Mount Everest, standing over there. The founder of REI and, you know, all these things. And then I hired, with the leftover money, I hired him and I hired, Vince Lombardi Jr. And we put on a big leadership event. That was sort of my kickoff event. And he said, you mortgaged your house. I said, yep, I mortgaged my house. And I remember saying to my wife, I said, what happens if this fails? In 2002, I was 36. So what happens is if this fails? She said, we're 36 and we'll start over again.
That's amazing. That was going to be one of my questions is like, who did you run that by? And did you give it any kind of consideration of what happens if this doesn't work out? But it's awesome to have a partner like that who said, hey, I've got your back. And if this doesn't work out, we're going to figure out a way to make it work. Now, thank you for sharing that story. So Zig, Rome, and Maxwell, did they ever give you a piece of advice where at first you said to yourself, no, there's no way that I'm going to subscribe to this. I don't believe this to be true. But then it turned around and they were actually right.
Off the top of my head, I don't remember any of those. But I will tell you the greatest lesson I learned from working with, I typically, you know, at the end of a lot of podcasts, they say, you know, what was it like working with Jim Rohn and Zig Ziglar? And I'll tell you the greatest lesson I learned from working with Jim Rohn and Zig Ziglar was to be myself. And I'll tell you why. Jim and Zig were contemporaries. They were friends. They were both at the top of the speaker world. And you could not have picked two far more different people than Jim and Zig. Zig was all over the stage in high voice and low voice and pumping his fist. And then he'd kneel down and he'd talk like this. And Jim, and he would work the crowd afterwards. He's out shaking hands. And, you know, I always say he could have been a politician, you know, shaking hands and kissing babies. And Jim didn't come early. He came 5 minutes early. He left as soon as he could get out of there because he was an introvert. He did not get energy from crowds. In fact, I always joke, those of you who are watching this, I always joke, you knew when Jim was getting excited because he did this. Like his big move was taking his reader glasses off. Like, uh-oh, here goes Jim. He's going off the rails, took his reader glasses off. And what I realized was I don't have to be Zig because Jim isn't Zig. And I don't have to be Jim because Zig isn't Jim. What I need to be is myself and my own personality, let my own personality shine through. And that's the biggest lesson that I learned from working with Jim and Zig was to be myself.
So what I hear you saying is, which I agree with, is it's incredibly important to be authentic and genuine when it comes to, I don't know, being a parent, being a leader or whatever, right? Because if you are, then people trust you more and believe in you.
Absolutely. When we can show transparency, particularly weakness, now you have to be You have to be circumspect with what kinds of things you share, right? You know, you don't want to get in front of your staff of 100 people and say, I'm really struggling with sexual addiction.
They're going to be like, I'm out of here.
Or, hey, maybe I could get a lawsuit out of this or, you know, something. But when we share our weakness, people appreciate that, because what it does is it removes the mystique. Because if you're really honest, we all know, just being human beings, that everybody struggles. And I tell people the only thing that rich people have that poor people don't is money. I mean, that's the big difference, is they buy nicer cars. They don't have to worry if their transmission goes out, if the water heater goes out. But you know what? They have marriage problems. They have children who go astray. They get cancer. They go bankrupt. You know, all these kinds of things. And so I feel like, from a leadership perspective, when we can appropriately share our weakness that we struggle with and how we're conquering it and, you know, those kinds of things in particular moments, I think it makes people saddle up with them. I had a pastor one time told me, a pastor should never admit weakness. And I said, man, that is so wrong. Every single person in there is coming to church for one reason. They're struggling with something and they hope God can help them. And then they look at you and you're perfect and you never admit anything. And they go, well, I could never be like the pastor. But if you say, hey, I've been struggling with my weight and I've been really praying about, you know, getting my body in shape and, you know, whatever it is, my time management, whatever, they all go, oh, my pastor struggles too. I better listen to him and find out how he overcomes it. So I'm a big believer in transparency and authenticity, obviously given appropriateness to the particular situation you find yourself in.
So a lot of our listeners are first-time leaders. They get promoted from an individual contributor to a first-time leader role. And a lot of them are afraid to show weakness, because they want to make sure that people feel like that they're qualified for doing the job. So if I'm a listener and I've been in this new management role for 6 months and I'm thinking to myself, oh man, I'm one of these people who have never shown weaknesses and come across as a know-it-all, what's maybe one piece of advice you can give for them to change the way they go about things?
Well, first of all, you're not sharing your weakness all the time, like maybe 3% of the time. And the other 97% of the time, you're showing boldness and ambition and vision and leadership and all those kinds of things, right? The little piece is the one that makes you real. And what I would say is you almost always want to share weakness down the ladder, not up the ladder. The only time you share weakness up the ladder is if you're asking for advice. So maybe you go to your boss and say, hey, man, I've got so much on my plate right now. I really want to do my best job for you. You know, I noticed that you've built this amazing company and I look at your busy life and you just seem to have it mastered. You know, what are your best tips for making sure that I'm focused on the priorities and I'm focused on that? You're admitting weakness, but you're eliciting that person's help, and they want to help you because you're working for them and you're going to deliver something for them. So first and foremost, don't just be Debbie Downer walking around the office all the time, you know, womp, womp every time you talk. But, I think that tactically speaking, a little bit of weakness humanizes you and makes all these other stuff, the 97%, even more powerful.
And it allows your team or the people you work with to be able to feel more comfortable to share their own weaknesses and, you know, be honest and, again, transparent, which is a great leadership lesson. I love your story about Michelangelo freeing the angel inside the marble. And can you share that and how it relates to leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote a book. It's my highest ranking book ever. It was number 2 on the Wall Street Journal, number 7 on the New York Times, and it was number 3 on Amazon all week. The only books that beat me on Amazon were the pre-release of Harry Potter and the lost manuscript of J.R.R. Tolkien that his grandson found in the attic after he died. So I was like, if I'm going to be number 3, I'll be number 3 to those two guys. But, well, not guys, gal and a guy. That was the first book I wrote after I stopped ghostwriting for John Maxwell, because I realized I was giving all of my best ideas to John. And so I thought, okay, I'm not going to ghostwrite anymore. I've ghostwritten a few for some other business leaders recently, but particularly in COVID, when I wasn't giving speeches, I had guys that wanted to write books, big major brand guys, and so I wrote them for them. But The Angel Inside is taken from an apocryphal story where supposedly a little boy came up to Michelangelo while he was working on the David and said, "Sir, why are you hitting that rock?" And he said, "There's an angel inside and I'm setting it free." So that's where the title, The Angel Inside, comes. Now, what's interesting is that that piece of marble had been in workshops all around Florence since before Michelangelo was even born. And two or three other artists had been commissioned to it, but it appeared to most artists that that was a defective piece of marble. It was a huge piece of marble, but the way the grains and everything's go, nobody ever stuck a chisel to that marble. And so Michelangelo grows up, he leaves home at 14 because his dad wanted him to be a politician, not an artist. In the early 1500s, artistry was not the widely considered profession that it is now. He does a little thing called the Battle of the Centaurs, which was a small little relief that gave him some like, wow, this is great. He goes to Rome. He does the Pietà, which personally is my favorite Michelangelo. It's beautiful. It's hauntingly beautiful. You know, the full risen Christ laying across his mother's lap. Interesting story about the Pietà. Michelangelo never signed a piece of artwork except the Pietà. And the reason why is he went back to Florence. And somebody said, "Oh, did you see that new statue that so-and-so did?" And he goes, "Which one?" He says, "Oh, it's in the basilica there. And it's the full-grown Jesus laying across the lap of his mother." Michelangelo gets on his horse, goes back to Rome, and chisels his name across the sash. So there's a big sash of Michelangelo because somebody else was getting credit for it. Anyway, he comes back and he does the David. Of course, and I tie in some of the biblical stories of the David, the actual David, one of which is a great story, and really probably the primary story of the book is that you should follow your own dreams, not somebody else's. So Michelangelo's dad wanted to be a politician, and that was the birth of early 1500s Florence was the birth of citizen legislatures. It's where Machiavelli served. Machiavelli was in the citizen legislature there in Florence. So imagine this, a 50,000 person city had Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Machiavelli, and Raphael a lot of the time was living there as well. A town of 50,000 people with those four great artists. So the story of the biblical David is interesting because if you remember the story, right, Samuel was told by God to go to this guy's house and choose his son to be the next king. So he shows up, Samuel shows up at Jesse's house and he says, "Yeah, God told me one of your sons is the next king of Israel." And so Jesse calls in his sons and Samuel goes, "It's not him, it's not him, it's not him, it's not him, it's not him. Do you have any other sons?" And he goes, "Well, I got this kid. He's out tending the sheep." He says, "Bring him in." Brings him in. And he says, of course, this is the next king of Israel. And then he says to Jesse, he says, "Remember, man looks on the outside. God looks on the inside." And that's exactly what Michelangelo did to that big giant thing. Everybody was looking at the outside and thinking, "Well, this will break." He saw the greatest statue ever made inside that marble. He just had to get rid of everything else around it. And so, you know, the big lesson of that story, and again, it's a mentor mentee. The book opens with a young 28-year-old American who's lost hope in life and he doesn't like being in business. And he's sitting on a park bench like this. And a little old Italian man comes up to him and says, "Why do you look so downcast?" And it's their whole afternoon together. It's the whole book is one afternoon together. The final pages are the next morning, but the whole book is their afternoon together. And the lesson is, follow your passion. Don't let somebody else determine what your life is supposed to be. Even if it's your parents, you don't have to go do what your parents want you to do. You're an adult now. Go pick your life, live your life, make the most of your life. And that's really what that book is all about.
So if you look at it from this perspective, a lot of our listeners, of course, are parents, right? And for me, I was a baseball player. My dad wanted me to be a baseball player. I got pretty far, got drafted, you know, played in college and everything, but he didn't force me to be that way. But what advice do you have for parents who are overbearing and try to push their kids in a direction that maybe the kids don't want to go? How do they allow them to explore what could be best for them?
I think the number one job, we as parents are stewards. Because eventually those kids leave. The real core of the family is the mom and dad, because they're the only part of the family that's there the whole way through. The kids go off and they start their own families. They create their own mission in life and those things. They're always sort of appendages to the family, right? But they come home to the family for Christmas and Thanksgiving and those kinds of things. So I told my kids, my biggest job is that when you turn 18, you are fully prepared to live life. That was my only job. I didn't care what they wanted to do. I had one daughter that came to me and she said, Dad, I don't like school. I love my job. She had a job at a kind of a boutique little grocery store that had like 11 stores around the Seattle area. It was kind of like a very small Whole Foods. She came to me and said, I don't want to go to college. I don't want to be successful like you. I just want to live a nice life. And I said, okay. She said, I want to get my GED and just go work full time. And I said, it's your life. But here's my rules. You have to get your GED. You have to have a 40-hour a week job and you have to be able to pay rent. And so, darn it, if she didn't end up going off, she found a single mom who had an extra room to rent. She paid the rent. She had a 40-hour job. She ended up being the grocery manager buyer for that chain of grocery stores. And she did, you know, well for herself. I had one daughter who she got married to a Navy boy, although he's only ever been with the Marines. He's a corpsman. And it's the only Navy guys that the Marines like are the corpsmen, because they're the doctors and they don't have their own. So he went to Afghanistan, Camp Leatherneck. She moved back in. And in fact, she had moved in a little bit even before they got married, I think. And then when they got married a couple months later, he shipped out. But anyway, we were at a funeral for my nephew who had passed away. And I was talking to all of my daughter's cousins and everything. And one of them had just moved back in with her mother, my sister. And I said, hey, I heard you moved back in with your mom. And she said, yeah. And I said, what's she charging you for rent? And she laughed and she said, she doesn't charge me anything for rent. And I said, well, you're lucky you're not my kid, because I charge rent. She goes, you do not charge rent. And I said, when you're 18, if you're not in college, you pay rent at my house. She goes, no way, you're busting my chops. And Hannah, my daughter, who was paying me rent, I said, I won't say a word. Hannah, come here. I yelled at her across the, it was during the reception afterwards. Hannah comes over. I said, Teresa has a question for you. Does your dad charge you rent? She said, yep, $400 a month. But I prepared her to pay $400 a month. I prepared that daughter who got her GED to go out and do that. And I think that's, your job is not to choose what they should do and force them to do it. Your job is, because your kids all have different skill sets. They all have different mentalities. They all have different giftedness. You know, you take some person that could end up a great chef and you turn them into an accountant. Sure, you won, but they're miserable. So my job was really, I viewed it as a stewardship that ended on their 18th birthday. And my job was to make sure they were fully prepared. In fact, I got a great piece of advice when the kid, my oldest, was probably 14, and I applied it. They said, you know, most parents have a curfew on their children, and then they go to college. What you should do is you should increase the curfew, and their senior year should be the first time they have no curfew. And I said, well, why is that? He said, you want the first year of their total freedom to be when they're living in your house, not at a college campus. So my only rule was all of my kids, when they were seniors, had no curfew. You can go do what you want, go where you want. There's only two rules. If I call you, you answer the phone. And number two, you tell me where you're at. And I don't care where that is. We're going into downtown Seattle. We're going to go, you know, we're going to go to dinner, and then we're going to go to the bar, and then we're going to go dance at one of the clubs. Perfect. No problem. And they all experienced their first year of total freedom while still under my care. But I was stewarding them so that when they left the home, either to go to college or to go to work, it wasn't a free-for-all. Their first taste of total freedom was when I still was stewarding them and pushing them towards their ultimate destination.
That's great advice, because you've seen the situations where the parents are just micromanage everything and they don't give them any freedom. And then the kids get out into college and they go hog wild. And similar to my situation, I was very fortunate with my parents, is they told us the difference between right and wrong, what to do, what not to do. But they gave us the freedom to, as long as we followed their rules, that we were able to go out and experience life. And I think that that has a big difference in why the four of us turned out okay. I think that's incredible advice. Let's move on and talk a little bit about your new book, The Coming American Revival. So to begin with, what does revival mean to you and what inspired you to write it now?
Well, so I'll start with the second half. I was writing The Capitalist, and I just felt this strong urge to write a book on revival. That's all it was. I stopped writing Capitalist and wrote this. And the response has been pretty amazing. But I wrote this book and I started doing some research, and I realized that, well, first of all, the word revival literally means to come alive again. And so it's about igniting, the subtitle is The Biblical Blueprint for Igniting a Nation's Soul. It's about the people of faith reigniting their faith and having a real faith instead of just something like, well, you know, I go to church once a week or, you know, once a month, and, you know, I'm sort of in the periphery or whatever. I don't really practice much. But it's about practicing your faith and the disciplines of your faith and those kinds of things. But when I wrote that book, I started doing research. There's been maybe five or six revivals, full-blown, widespread revivals in America. First Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, Third Great Awakening, the Azusa Street Revival of the early 1900s, which produced Azusa Pacific down there in L.A. And then the last one was the Jesus People Movement, the early 1970s, Chuck Smith, Calvary Chapel Movement. And then I looked for books that had been widely read on revival. There had not been a widely read book on revival since the 1950s, when a British guy who was living in America, Leonard Ravenhill, wrote a book called Why Revival Tarries. And so I realized that historically, we're on the verge of a revival. Just you know, every 50 to 70 years, there's a widespread revival. Now, what's interesting is there's lots of little bubbles right now. If you Google search or whatever search engine you use, a college campus revivals, it's happening all over the country. I mean, I'm in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Right up the road in Cleveland is Lee University. And a couple of years ago, in fact, Tucker Carlson covered it two or three times and then sent a film crew there. These kids went in for chapel one day and didn't leave for 2 weeks. They just experienced this renewal, this refreshing, this, personalization of their faith. It was no longer cerebral, but it was heartfelt. And, I just believe that all of our problems are solved with revival. I tell people all the time, our political problem is not the problem. Our real problem in America is our spiritual problem. If we solve the spiritual problem, it solves the political problem. But so many people place their hope in politics, and I'm very politically involved. I've been very, very, very politically involved. But I also realize that what's happening in America today, the political problems are really spiritual problems, and I believe that a revival of people's faith is the kind of thing that transforms their personal life. I have a different section in the book on how revival affects your family, how revival affects your business. I also have one on how revival would affect politics. And imagine, if you think about it, if you come to grips with your faith and you have a personal revival, well, one of the first things you're going to do is you're going to not lie anymore. Could you imagine all the ads during a presidential campaign where nobody gets to lie, you know? Could you imagine if a man who's a bully to his family has a spiritual revival and now he loves his wife and treats his children beautifully? So to me, revival is the thing that really solves our problems. Sometimes people say, oh, you know, you can't rule by Christianity. And you're right, we can't rule by Christianity. I don't believe in the idea of a Christian nation, because nations can't be Christians. People are Christians. Now, those people, as they get involved in politics, they bring their values and those kinds of things. But I just think it's important for us to see our own personal revival. That's where it all starts. It starts with one man or one woman saying, I want to take my faith seriously. And that begins to transform others around them as they treat them. People say, well, you can't be ruled by Christians. But I always say, what are you afraid of? Is it the part that says, love your neighbor? Is it the part that says, love one another, bear with one another, be patient with one another, forgive one another? Like, what are those themes of a vibrant faith that people are so terrified of? And I just really believe that if we live out of those principles, really, truly live them, It's the basis for humanity, real, loving, kind humanity.
I agree. But I also think our country is so divided right now, whether you want to say politically or spiritually, is it even possible to bring everybody back together?
Without spiritual revival, I do not believe it is. In fact, when I did a whole research project for the book about what came out of these great revivals, one of the best things was unity. In every single major revival that swept the nation, unity took place. It started with churches who normally see themselves as competitors, unifying and appreciating their own brothers and sisters who might go to a different church or whatever. But here's the major problem that I see in our country today. If you go back 70, 80 years, and then, of course, all the way back to the founding of our country, everybody essentially had the same worldview. And it was the traditional Judeo-Christian capitalistic worldview. In the late 60s, early 70s, there was an up-and-coming worldview. It was the secular humanist, Marxist, socialist, God is dead worldview. And Robert Bork, those of you who follow politics, you realize he was the Nixon's solicitor general. And as everybody got fired, he ended up being the guy at the top. And then he was appointed to the Supreme Court and he got borked. That's where the term borked comes from. In 1999, he wrote a book called Slouching Towards Gomorrah. And he outlined how for the last 30 years, there was a worldview that decided to take over. The people who held this worldview said the only way to really change America the way we want it to be, this Marxist, socialist, secular humanist, was to take over the institutions. And from the 1960s to today now, 25 years after he wrote that book, Slouching Towards Gomorrah, you see that that's exactly what happened. They took over Hollywood. They took over the public education. And they demanded adherence to their particular, and then once they gained control of it, they would only let people in who would, promote that particular thing. So here's what we have now in America. We have the traditional Judeo-Christian worldview versus the secular humanist, God is dead Marxist worldview. And I think the two could probably even coexist, except for this one thing. Both sides view themselves as having a moral imperative. You know, we've had Democrats and Republicans back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and they would argue things out, but they came from the same worldview. They differed on strategy. They differed on technique. They differed on the plan, but they all essentially wanted to get to the same place. Now, both these groups want to go to a different place. They don't just say, I'm right and you're wrong. They say, I'm good and you're evil. And that creates this moral imperative that does not allow them to, I mean, are you gonna give in to the evil guy who wants to do something that you don't want to? Well, of course not. He's evil. If he just differed with me and I still respected him and admired him and just said, hey, he's got a different idea, then there can be coexistence. There can be this interaction. There can be negotiation. There can be all that. But when you view yourself as good and the other side as evil, you must fight to the death. And you know what would solve that? Revival. Where you no longer view your opponent as the enemy, an evil person, but instead they're a person who disagrees with you, and you might even think that some of what they promote is not good for our country, but it takes the tone down, takes the tone way down, and allows us to disagree. One of the beautiful things about America is that we're free. We're free to have ideas. We're free to disagree. We're free to say things that people don't like. But we're now, with the cancel culture, you can't even say certain things or you're going to get fired. I had a guy once, we were playing poker together, and he threatened to throw me out. And I'm like, why? I can't remember what I had said. And I said, well, that's what I really think. And he goes, you need to keep your mouth shut or you're not going to be able to play poker with us anymore. And I said, okay, I'll just think it. And he said, you're not even allowed to think it. And I was like, wow.
What's wrong with people?
What's wrong with people, right?
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is we got to switch it up from thinking good and evil to we just think differently. And being okay with accepting that other people think differently. And even before we jumped on camera, I was talking about friends who I may not agree with, but at least we can have a conversation and learn from each other. So if you take, let's take your book. So if someone wants to start making changes after reading your book, you know, where should they start?
Well, the book, I put a bunch of, this is not my typical 20,000 word book. This is, you know, a little bit thicker. But I end the book with a 31 day devotional. Each day has, I start with 10 days on personal revival, 10 days on church revival, and 10 days on national revival. And each one has a biblical verse. It has a thought for the day. It has a prayer, and it has an action point. So it specifically says, you want personal revival? Here's the lesson for today. Go do this. And I think the way you start is you start with what you already know. I think anybody who's even shown up in church once or twice knows that you're supposed to love your neighbor. It's the story of the Good Samaritan, right? Jesus said the second commandment is just, you know, first commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, strength, and soul. And the second one is just like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Okay. So you don't need a whole lot of teaching to say, okay, how am I going to love my literal neighbor who leaves his garbage cans on my dividing line of our properties? We don't go over and go, you stupid blankety blank, blank, blank. That's not loving. It's to approach and to act loving. It's being kind. It's praying for people. You know, one of the things that I do to redeem my scrolling is every day when I, most days, not every day, but most days, the very first 10 people who I see posts from, I pray for them. And then I send them a message. And I say, every day I pray for the first 10 people I see, and today I'm praying for you. You wouldn't believe the amazing stories and the thankfulness that I get. One of the craziest stories, I sent it to this older woman. I'd never met her, but she's an editor and a writer. So I know her. She's a Facebook friend. She's in her 70s. And I sent her that message. I said, I prayed for you today. She wrote me back and she said, Chris, I looked at my bank account this morning when I first got up and I have bills coming due. I have no idea how in the world I was going to pay those bills. Then I got your message that you prayed for me. So I decided to open my bank account again. She said, I got a deposit this morning for $2,900 from a company that I tried to get a refund from 18 months ago, and they told me they wouldn't pay it. It came through this morning when you said you prayed for me. Well, you can imagine she's appreciative of our relationship. She's appreciative that God cares for her and sent me to pray for her and tell her I was praying for her so that she could give glory to God when she got that $2,900 check. Because if I wouldn't have told her that, I would have still prayed for her. But if I didn't tell her that and she got the $2,900, she'd have said, oh, that's fantastic. But instead she said, I'm thankful to God that he provided for me today.
That's a great story. So I'm a Christian, right? And I feel like I have a good relationship with God, but I'll be honest with you, we don't go to church nearly as much as we should. I don't want to make excuses, right? Two young kids, whatever it is, right? But what would you say for a guy like me who I feel like I have a great relationship, should I feel bad and go to church more often?
Well, you should never go to church because you feel bad, right?
And
I get all the reasons. I was a pastor for 14 years. I get all the reasons to not go to church, you know, but, there's something about being part of a community of faith, whether it's you go to church or you have a few other families where you get together and you share your faith together, or maybe you're in a men's group or your wife's in a women's group. But it's less about going to church. In fact, here's the interesting thing. Every time the word church is used in the New Testament, it's never used to describe a building. It's describing the group of people who followed Christ. That's the church. It's not a building. So, you know, Jesus said, wherever two or three of you are gathered in my name, I'm right there with you. So to me, should you go to church? Yeah, I think we should all be involved in a church because you're going to be around people who are experiencing great things with God, and you're going to experience some people that are having bad things with God and struggles. But you're going to be part of that faith, just like you are in your family. You know, or your group of friends. You might not have anything religious about your group of friends, but some of them are going through divorces. Some of them have a kid who's gone astray. Yeah, and you support each other. Really, the idea of church is to support one another, but from that Christian context. I'll tell you a funny story. When I used to preach, every once in a while, I'd say, every couple of years, this would come out of my mouth. I'd say, you know, I know what some of you think about the church. I know you're like, oh, it's filled with hypocrites, this, that, and the other thing. And I said, folks, here's the deal. If you knew what went through my mind sometimes, you wouldn't come to church here. And they'd all kind of chuckle a little bit. And I'd say, whoa, hold on. If I knew what was going through your mind half the time, I wouldn't let you come to church. Church is not about perfect people. Church is about broken people who are together and they're sharing their journey of faith. Some of them are further along in their faith and some of them are brand new. But that's the beauty of it. So should you go to church? I believe that being in a fellowship of believers is an important thing. Does it mean you go sit in a building every Sunday morning? Not necessarily.
Well, thanks for sharing that. And I think that's great.
And if you need a note to your pastor, let me know. I'll write a note.
Well, I liked one idea that you had, and that was to buy two copies of your book, one for yourself and one for your pastor. If you want to share what your thoughts are around that.
Sure. You know, I had a pastor tell me the people who are going to be most resistant to this message of revival are the pastors, because they've kind of built their thing. They've got it going. The money's coming in. Everything, the programs are all working, and they don't want to upset the apple cart, right? So one of the ideas that I've been telling people is buy one copy for yourself, one copy for your pastor. Go to your pastor, say, I bought a book for you. I'm wondering if you would read it and go to lunch with me in a month and we could talk about it. Now you've got your pastor thinking about revival. He knows that he has an advocate for revival in the church. You get to go and have a conversation and say, how could we see our church have a stronger, because I think they think revival means, you know, certain things, but really all it means is a strengthening of the people who are already in his church. A more, you know, when they say, hey, we need 30 volunteers this weekend and nobody shows up. If all of a sudden everybody's passionate about the mission of the church, then when he says, hey, do we need 30 volunteers this weekend for XYZ thing we're doing? Well, now you get 50 volunteers instead of 7 volunteers, because now everybody, their faith, their personal faith has been revived and they want to serve and those kinds of things. So that's my idea. Buy one copy for your pastor, give it to him and ask him to go to lunch with you a month later, having read the book.
Coach Steve, who's a pastor who I go to lunch with every once in a while, I can't wait. Hopefully he watches this episode and I'm going to get him a copy, and then him and I will go to the Lighthouse down the street and talk about it a month later. He'll be the most pumped up guy around, because he always is trying to share with me more about that. So as we wrap up, what's one thing that you want to challenge every listener to start doing today to become a better leader, to deepen their faith, or maybe just create some positive change in the world?
Well, I'll tell you a story. It's a crazy story, but it produced the motto that I've lived my life by for 35 years. Well, it happened in 1990, so 34 years. So I was a young pastor in northern New Jersey. I told you about that. And I went to a conference, and I think it was in Alberta, Canada, if I remember right. And you know how you go to a conference, you don't know anybody, so you stand in the hallway with your little coffee and you're just going, do, you know, whatever. So I turn around and I come face to face with a 55-year-old woman and a 30-year-old woman about. And I just, bam, they were right there. I turned around, bam. The younger girl, who I found out later through the story, was the daughter of the older woman. She does this. She goes, she looked like she'd seen a ghost. And her mother turns to her, looks at me, looks at her, looks at me, looks at her, and says, is that him? And I'm like, what kind of trouble have I got myself into? And the daughter still has not spoken a word. She goes like this. The mother then turns to me to explain this crazy situation that's happening. And she says, last night at 2 a.m., my daughter woke up, startled asleep, shook me, and said, Mom, I just had this dream where I saw this man's face, and I was told that I need to tell him something. Well, here I was. So she looks at her daughter and says, she thumbs me. She goes, so tell him. The only words this woman spoke to me, the young girl, I don't know their names, never followed up with them, don't know where they lived, don't know where they went, never saw them again. The young girl says her first words, and she says, I'm supposed to tell you to be a voice, not an echo. And I've lived my entire speaking career around that theme, be a voice, not an echo. As a leader, we're not just regurgitating things that everybody else says. Granted, you can benchmark, you can bring in, you know, good tactics. You can bring in good strategies, good skill sets, learn how to time manage. But at the core, leaders need to be a voice, not an echo. And we need to speak what we've lived, what we've learned, what our wisdom is. And the older you get, your knowledge turns into wisdom. It's one of the things I really like about being 58 because, you know, I had all these older men who were my mentors, like the guy, the CEO of Mars. And then I looked in the mirror about 2 years ago, and I went, wow, you're the older man now. So now I really look to take that knowledge, which turned to wisdom, which is applied knowledge. And I try to help younger men with that now, cut their learning curve off and all those kinds of things. I have a good friend named Mark Sanborn, and he's sold 5 million copies of a book called The Fred Factor, former president of the National Speakers Association, one of the most in-demand speakers of the last 30 years. Mark always says, you know the problem with most thought leaders? What? They don't think. For 30 years, Mark has taken 15 minutes a day. He shuts the door. He sits in a chair. He has nothing but a pen, a yellow legal pad, and his brain. For 15 minutes. Not much, but 15 minutes over 30 years every day? That adds up to a lot. That's how you become a thought leader. You don't become a thought leader by regurgitating and echoing what everybody else says. You become a thought leader, and yes, a leader, by being a voice, not an echo. And even though that was a sort of a personal word given to me, now I look it up online, and it's like it's Albert Einstein said it. Well, it's kind of like, you know, 90% of all statistics are wrong on the internet, signed Abraham Lincoln. Like, you never know. You never know where the quotes are coming from. And I don't care if it was Albert Albert Einstein who said it or not. It was something that I've built my entire career off of. Be a voice, not an echo. And, you know, you probably realize that the people in Silicon Valley, the people who get the wealthiest, are the people who come up with something new. They're the voice. They're not the echo. They're not a Me Too, not the original meaning of Me Too, not the current meaning of Me Too. They're not a Me Too company. You know, would you rather be Coke or would you rather be Pepsi? Well, I'd rather be Coke, right? You know, or whatever. But that's what I'll leave you with. Be a voice, not an echo. It's not a tactic. It's not a technique, but it's something that comes from your core. And it means that you are committed to knowledge and wisdom.
What an experience this has been, Chris. And speaking of your wisdom, where can we connect with you to learn more from you?
Sure. Yeah. ChrisWeidner.com. You can send me an email. I'm the only one that gets them. I don't have an admin. That I handle all my own stuff. That was actually given to me by the CEO of Mars. He said, Chris, I'm gonna give you some advice. He gave me lots of advice, but the one he said, always answer your own phone. And I tried it once. I called the headquarters at Mars and I said, yeah, I'd like to talk to, and I named his name. And the phone rang, bam, he answered it. And he didn't know I was calling through the system or whatever. And I've been surprised over the years how many times people have called me, you know, and I answer the phone. They go, oh, hi, is this Chris? Yeah, this is Chris. Oh, I didn't expect to talk to you. Well, here I am. What do you want to talk about? So anyway, they can reach me at chris@chriswidener.com is the easiest way to get a hold of me. They can find all my books on Amazon. They can find that book that we talked about at Coming American Revival, which just sends them straight into Amazon. So
you're probably going to get a lot of calls from our listeners after this.
I hope I do. I hope I do. And I'll answer the phone. There won't be some admin. I'll tell you a funny story. I got a guy who runs a $100 million a year company up in Seattle, a friend of mine. And I posted this past week. I said, my biggest pet peeve. I'm like, sending me to somebody else to schedule the time when we're on, like, hey, are you available next Tuesday at 2? I don't know. Get a hold of my admin. Okay. So I wrote, hey, Joker. In the time it took you to tell your admin to book me, you could have just told me you're available Tuesday at 2. So anyway, this buddy of mine, real good friend of mine, he always does this to me. He posts on the comment. He goes, and I actually said, hey, Joker, blah, blah, blah. He said, Chris, I am so guilty of this. And yes, I'm a joker. And yes, you're my peer and my colleague, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I wrote him back and I said, David, I said, the one kind of group that I give, you know, grace to is the people who are on the road all the time. And he's on the road all the time. I can't remember the last time I talked to him in his office. I said, you guys kind of need to have, you know, somebody back at the home office, whatever. So I said, it's all good. And I ended that little comment by saying, I'll connect with Janet and I'll get a call on the books next week. So I reached out to his admin. I said, hey, David and I want to get on the phone next week. When's he available? So, anyway, answer your own phone is a great one. And, you know, we learn these little tricks from people who've gone before us.
Thank you, Chris. And for our listeners out there, what I want you to do is I want you to think about somebody or a bunch of people, I know I have, who can benefit from this and text this episode to Chris. And so they could learn from him, whether it's about leadership, whether it's about faith, or really how we can go about this revival for America. Because at the end of the day, we're still the greatest country in the world. So until next time, everybody, stay curious, keep learning, and have a great day. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you for having me.